From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR's correspondents from around the globe. I'm Kevin Beasley. This week, the floods in Pakistan, civilian war deaths in Afghanistan, and a look at the Russian city of St. Petersburg. Water from the disastrous floods in Pakistan is now beginning to reach the Arabian Sea, leaving behind it a trail of devastation that has affected about 20 million people. The floods began about a month ago in the mountainous northwest of Pakistan. As the swollen waters slowly moved down through the country, people fled their homes and abandoned their fields and animals and tried to find shelter on higher ground. This week, the floodwaters reached the city of Shadakot in Sindh province. NPR's Julie McCarthy was there.
We're standing at the embankment that is protecting the city of Shadakot, and water is sweeping past here. At least 500 yards of water in front of us. Behind us is the city. And there's been a mad dash to try to shore up the embankments so that the city doesn't get swamped. Nadir Mugsi, a member of the Sindh Provincial Assembly, led the community in building this levee, but the danger has not passed. Water is rising at places to within a foot of the top of this dirt and stone barrier. It's all that separates the city of 200,000 people from inundation. Mugsy says on the other side of the levee, outlying villages are drowning along with massive rice fields.
Thousands of acres of rice crop, thousands of people, it's all wiped out. There's nothing left. They've never seen water like this, and it just keeps on going. You know? I mean, it's terrible.
Rajesh Chawla stands at the top of the levee and surveys the landscape utterly altered by the floods. Once velvet green rice paddies are now waves of fast-moving gray-green water. Chawla says the stocks in his two rice mills have been sealed and safeguarded from the flood, but that is scant consolation for a man whose fields now lie beneath a vast expanse of water. Chawla says there is no price tag for what has been lost. He speaks through an interpreter.
I can't explain how much I feel the pain. Not only the crops, not only the rice, but also the animals, livestock, and all those things connected with agriculture destroyed. So I have no idea what we lost.
In the midst of the calamity, an old man sits at the edge of the levee. Quran in hand, he mumbles prayers. He likened the flood to Judgment Day, a sentiment that many, who could not comprehend the magnitude of the water, repeated. What is unfolding now in Sindh has been unfolding throughout Pakistan for the past 3.5 weeks. The city of Shadakot has been emptied of its residents, fleeing as the floodwaters drew near. They have holed up in camps, some orderly, most ad hoc, with scant food and water. Many more have simply strung a rope and a cloth from a tree to make a bed. Millions of lives have been upended. Their future is uncertain, and the flood is not over. Julie McCarthy, NPR News, Shadakot, Pakistan.
The war in Afghanistan is posing some great challenges to American and allied forces, none more so than the issue of civilian casualties. In one recent example of the problem, American special forces, along with their Afghan interpreters, raided a home and announced that they'd killed 3 suspected militants. The next morning, hundreds of people blocked the highway nearby, protesting that the young men were actually college students home for the holy month of Ramadan. The United Nations says it's the Taliban, not the Americans, that caused 3/4 of civilian casualties in Afghanistan. But that's not what most Afghans think, as NPR's Quill Lawrence reports.
Taliban influence in the province of Wardak, southwest of Kabul, has surged in recent years. On the night of August 11th, U.S. Special Forces, along with Afghan soldiers, believed they had tracked a Taliban leader to one of 3 adjacent farmhouse compounds. Colonel John Dorian, a NATO spokesman, said the soldiers used standard operating procedure.
That means an Afghan interpreter uses a bullhorn to tell the occupants of the compound to come out with their hands raised. 2 men, 4 women, and 7 children complied with that call out.
Dorian says the civilians told the U.S. soldiers that no one remained inside the compound. They began clearing room by room.
When they reached this room, there were three men inside, one with an AK-47 rifle. That individual began raising the rifle, and the assault force engaged him and shot him dead. The other two men, rather than complying with a second call out, they moved toward the weapon and were also engaged.
In a matter of only seconds, three young men lay dead. They were 25-year-old Ismail Aman and two of his younger brothers. The family gives a starkly different account of what happened. A surviving brother, Muhammad Aman, was asleep when the raid went down.
It was about 2 a.m. in the morning that Americans came brutally entering our house. They made firing and they killed my three brothers who were students.
Aman says he and his father were strip searched and handcuffed in the yard before he realized that his brothers were dead.
I don't know why the Americans killed them, you know. I don't know that if they make a mistake. Because at least they could ask them, because two of them were English teachers, they could speak English. They could ask them that, you know, who you guys are.
Aman spoke at a small memorial service at the Kabul Vocational School where Ismail was studying business administration. He says his brothers were home from school and up late studying. He doesn't need to explain the gun, which is as common as a garden shovel here in Afghanistan. He says the next day, talk of vengeance against the Americans spread through the village. The mood here on campus is the same. Students vented their rage as they showed a visitor Ismail's dorm room, full of notebooks and texts in English. Karim lives down the hall.
I want to ask one question from American, why they are killing our innocent people, and they are killing a student, and they are saying they are Taliban, they are Al-Qaeda, and they are belonging with the terrorists.
This is exactly what the Americans say they have gone to great lengths to avoid, turning the population into Taliban sympathizers. To that end, airstrikes have been severely limited in favor of troops on the ground who can get a closer look at their targets. According to the United Nations and Afghan monitors, 76% of civilian casualties this year were caused by insurgents. The Americans are only blamed for 12% of them, but that information hasn't reached the students, like Hamza, another classmate.
You are the father of Ismail, and that's your three sons. And you 100% you become a Talib and you make a suicide attack on him.
The group is angry. They say the Americans have overstayed their welcome in Afghanistan. It doesn't seem to matter that Afghan authorities also sign off on these night raids. The students say President Hamid Karzai is an American puppet. In their minds, the Taliban carry none of the blame. And that's a problem, says Colonel John Dorian.
When we fail to make progress, we're easy to hold accountable. The Taliban, on the other side, over the years, they've become very good at assigning blame to others for casualties that they cause.
Dorian says on the same night that Aman's brothers died, special forces did arrest four men in neighboring compounds, but it's not clear they got the Taliban commander they were after. There's no evidence to suggest the young men killed in this case were Taliban. But Dorian insists that when a weapon is drawn on NATO or Afghan soldiers, they're correct to defend themselves. He adds that in 80% of these night raids, the call-out works and no shots are fired. But none of that is convincing to the family in Wardak. It's not clear if it will convince the Afghan people. Quill Lawrence, NPR News, Kabul.
Coming up, a look at the Russian city of St. Petersburg.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new MDX with super-handling all-wheel drive. More information is available at Acura.com.
This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Kevin Beasley. The Russian Emperor Peter the Great built St. Petersburg 3 centuries ago. He imagined the city as a luxurious playground for Russia's ruling elite. He also wanted it to be Russia's window to Europe. As NPR's David Green reports, there are some residents today who think that Russia's current leaders are using the city for the same purpose.
summer in St. Petersburg means these incredible white nights. The sun never sets over the canals and cafes, and this cultural capital explodes with life. There's a festival of boats on the river, fireworks, concerts. Who can blame Russian President Dmitry Medvedev for wanting to show off this place?
It also gives me a lot of pleasure to welcome you here at the St. Petersburg Economic Forum.
This summer, he used St. Petersburg as the backdrop to tell fellow leaders that Russia is modernizing.
Changing for its own sake, as well as for the sake of the rest of the world. Thank you.
This place was just a Swedish backwater until Russia claimed the territory 3 centuries ago, and Peter the Great built a grand Russian capital.
Actually, most European city of Russia.
This is Vladimir Gelman. He's dean of political science and sociology at the European University in St. Petersburg. Over lunch, he described how the Soviet government moved their capital to less glamorous but more functional Moscow. This city was renamed Leningrad. Hundreds of thousands here starved to death during the German siege in World War II. And over time, this city became dirty and crime-ridden. But through it all, Peter's European architecture remained. And today, two natives, Medvedev and Prime Minister Vladimir Putin, are leading a renaissance.
I mean, international events, more federal investments.
Really, the city's a showcase again, Gelman said. But he added a big caveat. When it comes to politics, he said, neither Putin nor Medvedev want Russia to be any more European.
Why there is a need? If they would like to redesign the country, yes, you are right. If they would like to make a showcase, one showcase is enough.
So it sounds almost like St. Petersburg is a little Russian playground. You can come here, you can think that you're enjoying Russia if you're a tourist.
To some extent it's true. And of course for tourists who are coming here for, 3, 4, 5 days, it looks like a European face of Russia. And if they will go just 100 kilometers out of the city, they will see an absolutely different landscape.
But many tourists don't go anywhere else, and that may be by design. The Russian government usually requires visitors from the U.S. or Europe to have an official invitation letter and a visa. Not here, though.
This is the biggest sculpture of the collection.
In the new St. Petersburg, they allow visitors off cruise ships and ferries to explore, if escorted at all times by an official tour guide.
And visiting just the points in the program, so they have no free time, they have no, no choice.
Elena Etzina is a curator at one of the hotspots, the Hermitage Museum. She's proud of the art collection, which rivals the Louvre. There are works from all the giants, Picasso, Da Vinci.
And we have more than 20 paintings by Rembrandt, and Return of the Prodigal Son, is considered to be probably the most well-known piece by Rembrandt.
But this European-style museum is only a taste of imperial Russia.
It's not right to say that I know what Russia is after visiting even St. Petersburg, and especially just the Hermitage Museum, because we have no Russian art here.
What does this city mean for the Russians who live here? I met Irorida Titova heading home on a city bus. She's a 66-year-old widow with a haunting past. As a child, she went with her father back and forth from here to Siberia. They were visiting her mother, who was deported by Stalin because of her German descent. I wondered whether today all the tourists in this European-feeling city bother her, passing through without learning much about the darker times.
Yes, one should live in Russia to really understand it. But people can come visit here, see something, and leave. Life was hard for me, but what is it for them? Why should they know?
And actually, Titova herself was on her way back from the Hermitage. I'm in a lovely mood, she said. I've just seen the Picasso exhibit. There was also 24-year-old street musician Victoria Grigorieva. Welcome to our cultural capital, she declared. Please, admire it. Her friend Andrei Galkin, though, said he can get frustrated. The 21-year-old worries that this gorgeous city may help visitors forget uglier sides of Russia, the corruption or the human rights abuses. Whenever Medvedev or Putin come for a big visit, he said, it means one thing, a police crackdown to make sure there's no mischief. They do hide the real life here, he said. They show off what they want to show off. David Green, NPR News, St. Petersburg, Russia.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Kevin Beasley.